Hello everyone, welcome back to Let's Talk Data. We're right in the heart of the festive season. I'm really grateful for the conversations, the reflections, and the community that has grown around this podcast. It feels like the perfect time to pause, to look back and have thoughtful conversations about leadership, impact, and the work that truly matters. With that in mind, my next guest is Blessing Ngaga, a seasoned technology and banking leader with a career that spans deep technical expertise, large-scale delivery, and executive leadership. Blessing currently serves as divisional executive for retail client experience delivery at Capitec, where he leads product development teams across the retail bank, shaping how millions of clients experience saving, transacting, and everyday banking. Before this role, he held several senior leadership positions at Capitec, including head of save and transact products and head of technology solutions, delivery, and academy, roles that placed him at the center of technology execution, talent development, and delivery excellence. Prior to Capitec, Blessing spent over a decade at Standard Bank in senior roles across infrastructure, operations, and international contracted services, working across global markets and complex regulated environments. Now, Blessing's career is grounded in a strong technical foundation. He began as a systems developer and over time progressed into senior leadership roles where he has led large complex teams and delivery environments across some of the country's biggest financial institutions. Blessing, it is such a pleasure to have you on Let's Talk Data. I'm really looking forward to this conversation.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Lebu. Thank you so much for the invitation.
Blessing, I've said a mouthful. How would you introduce yourself to someone who doesn't know you?
Really, I think, Lebu, the way I'd introduce myself is someone who's really inquisitive about how we can, unlock everybody's potential using technology. And when I say everybody, all the stakeholders, I often visualize the circles of life in a context that says there's Blessing in the center, but there's people around Blessing, and they come in different shapes, from family to community to actually, the corporate world we find ourselves in, to the country, ultimately globally. And the question is, how can we collectively work together in finding solutions and unlocking the true essence of how we make everybody's life a bit better? And so I'd love to, in every conversation, become, some sort of change agent. And that's how I'd introduce myself. So how can we make solutions together that makes our life better? That's who Blessing wants to be known as.
Lovely. Can you share a bit about your upbringing? I really enjoyed doing some research on your background. You are incredibly impressive. Would you say that excellence was inculcated in you from a young age? Take me back. Who is Blessing, and how did those early experiences shape the man that you are today?
Wow, Lebo, what a question. I think I grew up in a township called Kagiso, that is in the West Rand in Gauteng in Johannesburg, and I grew up in a very knit, close family with my parents, my mother and father. And I think from a very early on age, we had a context in the family of being community based, trying to find ways and means to support community, initiatives that enabled others to have a better life. And I think that was one element that came very strongly through my family and my growing up days. The other element that was very clear was a love for education. So my parents really encouraged me to always focus on learning and understanding new concepts and finding means and ways to understand other people, other concepts that related to technology, the economy, how things work. And generally, I was very, captured by engineering concepts, how things work. And my parents saw that quite early and they encouraged me to do that. And I think in my school career as well, I was someone who was really interested in debate, in conversation. Early on, was introduced to Toastmasters, got involved in church projects, trying to drive engagement with young people. And I think those elements, with my father's very clear outlook on life about being very, if I put it in a different way, finding means and ways to make things happen. My father had that outlook in life, and he inculcated that in me at quite an early age. And he tried to show me that, there's ways and means to get through life. And with that, I grew up quite early on into different positions. I think I was became in early leadership roles. You find yourself as call it part of the SR, or back then it was called Students Leadership Groups, and then ultimately became a head boy in high school, and ultimately found myself given opportunities all the way up into university to study at certain universities. So I think that really brought me to that place. But the one person who had quite a big impact on my growing up was my brother, because he essentially, my older brother was essentially someone who introduced me to technology, and he loved using technology on a daily basis. He got his first PC, he wrote some software, he played with some games, and ultimately he showed me a whole new life. And that meeting the love of language that I also had personally, and realizing what the power of technology can do, really had an impact on me. And I think that's why I ended up in the career that I have today.
Okay. Blessing, we are in such a fascinating moment globally. Everyone is experimenting with AI, new data tools, and digital platforms, but not every innovation translates into impact. And as we approach the end of 2025 and look ahead into a new financial year, how can leaders cut through the noise and ensure that technology investments are truly anchored in business strategy and not just in the hype?
Look, Lebo, I think that's one of the most important contexts that leaders must hold. And that for me is how to be focused on the outcome. What is your true outcome that you're trying to drive and enable? And it comes back to the question that ultimately for years we've always held as different, institutions. If you know what you exist for, who you exist for, what shift and change you want to make, and if you can measure it and you understand the insights that are telling you whether you're making the shift or not. Regardless of what the technology platform is, whether it could be AI, whether it could be you using cloud services, whether you could be using, digital technologies, ultimately the most important measure is the fact that you're reaching your outcome that makes the shift in actually the area of impact that you're wanting to make the impact. And I think when I think about AI, most of the conversations are geared in making sure that we are accelerating ourselves in adopting AI across the ecosystem of the enterprise. And that is it's so true that we need to evolve into the world where we leverage the importance of the technology. But if we're not understanding the shifts and the outcomes that are most important for us to make next in the enterprise, and are deploying AI just for the sake of accelerating that technology capability, we're missing the objective. And I think that's the biggest challenge that I would put out there, that you should already today as an enterprise or as an organization or as a group of people understand what are the pain points that either your clients or your stakeholders would like shifted. And on that basis, then you would deploy, even if it's proof of concept or proof of value initiatives in your organization in a safe manner, in a really measured manner, that are starting to shift those outcomes. And when you see those outcomes, then you go after the technology even more to enable you to do it. And I think that's the approach I would take, Lebo.
Great. So then, how then should leaders think about governance and measurement to ensure that they are actually tracking value? So what does good look like in practice?
So in reality, what I would propose is we understand today, for example, that when we measure the life cycle and journey that we want to enable for our clients, we start with, are we actually enabling the client to actually have the experience they want, to gain access to the services that they need, and ultimately to transact, for example, in the banking ecosystem in a safe, efficient, and valuable manner for them, right? One thing I would put in place is a measure of the client. How are we measuring our client satisfaction? How are we measuring our client, context in terms of them being serviced? That's number one. The other measure I would measure is how reliable are our services? Do we have the ability to understand ultimately at every given point what friction does the client have to overcome before they get to a place where they're satisfied with our services? And that will come from systems as well. Are we available? Is the service that we're providing not resulting in the client having to contact us? Are there any points of disappointment in that service? Do we need to put other measures in place or preventative measures to drive down that issue? The other one is the effort of use. Just how much effort does it take from a client from the state of where they are to a state where they're satisfied for them to get out of us the service they need? With those three measures in place, you can then go and start governing in the background your systems, your controls, your processes, and ultimately what your client outcomes are that are being measured. And I think I'm really positioning at quite a high level, but from the place of your data is complete and accurately categorized, and it's properly measured, and you understand whether your data is clean and well managed. So you're going to have to drive insights, meaning you're going to have to measure every single touch point interaction that your client has with you into your systems, into your environment. Your actual experience, you have to have measures that give you data points on how the client is experiencing your service. And then ultimately, you're going to have to understand the availability and stability and scalability of all your systems as well, and the reliability of those systems, and make sure that you architecture and you build for that ecosystem. And when you have the right governance in place in the organizations to measure those ultimate outcomes, and you have tolerance levels that are measured within the organizations, so that I think you can achieve the right level of oversight.
How important is tech fluency at the leadership level in making these AI and data investments successful? And what happens when those decisions are left solely to IT or technical teams?
Tech fluency is critical, but I think more and more as I think about it, you can balance tech fluency very well with business outcomes. It is crucial that you have a collaboration between business and technology leaders in every conversation. What I love about being in the organization I'm in at the moment is the fact that every conversation that we have around technology must be translated back into what it means from an outcome basis. Tech fluency for me has become the norm. There is no boardroom, there is no organization in the world that hasn't come to appreciate the importance of technology and the way it can disrupt or evolve or unlock, and accelerate strategy. And I think for every leader, nonetheless, on the C level, it is important for us to keep abreast of what technology can provide for us. And we see it more and more every day. You would think about your own context, your own family. I think about my own children, how fluent they are with technology concepts, which I think at their age, I was very much removed from what technology is. Today, it's embedded in what they do, whether you pick up your phone, whether you're on social media, or whether you're just having a conversation with an interesting channel. All of us are starting to understand it. And now everyone has got AI in their pocket, and they're actually using agentic AI without even thinking that they are. And the encouragement is that tech fluency at leadership level must inform all the different facets of leadership. People, process, technology, and strategy. And we must understand how those concepts across our business are being influenced by technology. And we use it to service, we use it to understand, which is the data. We use it to scale the business. We use it to reach unreached markets. We use technology to gather insights that make it strategically relevant. And we also use technology to monitor and understand what is actually happening in the business. Nothing today, and I think it's safe to say, nothing is left untouched by technology. Therefore, it is an integrated and intertwined capability in the business. Therefore, if you are a business leader today, you have to obsess with being technically fluent to a certain degree. But above it all, I think one of the things I want to leave everybody with is the humility of understanding and walking the journey of the person you're trying to service or reach. I think client centricity, without client centricity, tech fluency is just that, just tech.
You lead technology-enabled solutions for customer experience at scale. So when we talk about customer experience in 2025, what does that actually mean in practice?
So it means that an experience that the client would want to have with must be anticipated to be enabling, accessible, simplified, and almost an anticipating every single element so that it's convenient enough for the client at every level not to have to experience friction, experience disappointment, experience time being wasted in that experience, or just the lack of appreciation of the context of how that client operates. And I think about it in the South African context, we have so many different scenarios based on, call it, infrastructure's demographic account across the country. So what I mean by that is some people are able to wake up in the middle of the day and be on their cell phones and transact. Some clients are not able to get to a bank without having to drive across almost two towns in a taxi to get to the bank, and maybe the road infrastructure is not that great. And ultimately they might not even have the best connectivity to be able to do their banking. Now, if you look at those two scenarios, you have to design for that in mind when you design client journeys. You have to appreciate the fact that some journeys for a client are driven purely by self-service. Some journeys for the client are driven purely by you enabling them to get to that self-service level. It's almost an equality equation, if I put it that way, in the self-can context. And I think when we try and design those client experiences as an organization, we think about those things. Some example is some clients don't actually have access to data, but they require, if they did have access to data without having to actually put money aside to buy that data, they might be able to access your banking app. And just thinking about that differently allows a client to have access. You know, some clients might not necessarily have the ability to get to a branch. So just thinking about that differently might allow you to actually service the client remotely in a much more different way. So it's really the client journeys are really about finding the friction points that even the client with their best intention are not able to overcome actually move the other direction towards them. And that's been the mantra for me to say, if you just think about it from that point of view, and I think it takes a little bit of humility, but it just takes a little bit of just thinking on behalf or putting yourself in the shoes of the client and saying, there are certain things that even if the organization or the business is trying to give me the service, I would love to take your service, but I just have a friction point that I'm unable to overcome. Therefore, we as the business need to think about how we help our clients just get to a place of equality in terms of enabling themselves to service.
So from what you've seen, right? So what are the organizations that consistently deliver great customer experience get right and that others still might struggle with?
Again, Liv, it goes back to, I think they walk the shoes of the clients. They walk the journey in the life of the client. I think some of my most ex favorite experiences, I think about the airline businesses and it's anticipating my every move. You know, certain airline companies, you're able to book a ticket and they track you from the moment that you've booked the ticket. They give you notifications every second when the plane is ready to onboard, when can you check in, your luggage, you know, where your boarding gate is, what time are you boarding, your boarding gate has changed, notifying you whether the queues are long at the airport, letting you know whether you should get there early, giving you a sense. So all of those type of, you are in my experience journey and you are almost a digital twin in my service journey without me having to inquire or ask. Or and by so doing, the level of convenience that I experience is, you know, it's beyond expectation. And I think you can only find that, and I'll go back to the organization. I mean, I think at Capitec it's just amazing how in the 25-year history, very little has changed in the mindset. In fact, it's even gotten strengthened where our founding members walked the streets of the country. They went to all our different regions in the country and they walked the streets and they talked to the people on the ground. They understood what they could, they're intending to do, which is the same as everybody in the world, right? Make their financial lives better. Everybody's intending to do that, you know, create generational changes in their world and get access to things that allow them to do that. No one does not want to do that. But beyond that, they understood, okay, but how do you wake up in the morning? How do you get to work? How do you get to a bank? What time does a bank close? Bank closes at 3. A simple question like that. But why does a bank have to close at 3 when some of our people only are able to, you know, get to a bank on the weekends because they have to get onto a taxi at 4 o'clock and drive all the way back home and they're only home by 7. So banks opened up a bit later at Capitec. That was an innovation, what, 25 years ago, had nothing to do with technology. But again, the essence is in that the organizations that are getting client experience correct. And I can use all the methodologies of their client experience and I can use design thinking, I can use ideation. I'm literally shying away from all those technical concepts, which I'm glad we could go all read about it. But when you ideate, when you do design thinking, when you do a client journey map, when you map up the different experiences and the touch point of the clients, what's at the heart of it is the humility of actually having walked the journey.
I love how everyone is talking about building data literate workforces, but I'm curious, how do you think organizations can measure whether these initiatives are actually moving the needle and not just building skills, but changing how the business performs?
I think one of the things which I've been excited about developing within the organization has been to find a key concept that we all agree with in the organization that helps us measure a specific move in context of the business. For example, we've termed something called product health within the organization, which I've been involved in for the last 18 months. And you asked me about how can we make sure that everybody's becoming a data system citizen in the organization. I think it's in finding those key specific value points that we want to measure and democratizing them across the organization so that everybody has got the same language. So product health in the context of maybe this conversation as well is something we develop for each and every business owner in the organization to have a measure for their own business across their products, and has three simple pillars that are linked to it. One of them is the sentiment of the client. How does the client actually experience and understand how your specific business and product is being experienced by them? So we find multiple data sources that we already have in the business, funny enough, and we actually incorporate those data sources into a measure that gives us a score. Then we look at the effort of use. I mentioned that earlier on in the organization, we look for data points that tell us that for your business and your product, the interaction that your client is having, how much of that is based on the client being maybe disappointed or unhappy with the level of experience that they've had over the last couple of call it life cycle of your product. And that then is the second data point that we use. And the third one was reliability. And there we look at systems availability, we look at the disruption, we look at the amount of change you introduce and how much of that change is enhancements and improving. You take all those three data points and you give it a score, and you then get each and every business owner to gain insights and understanding to the point of coming up with initiatives that they will then drive out to increase their score. And I think that's an example of practically and pragmatically how you make sure that everybody becomes a data citizen. Because over time, through that experience, people start engaging those data points. They start asking the questions, why don't I have better insights? What data am I missing? What data information can I get from which other data sources? And you might find in that ecosystem is that's just the maturity of your systems or the maturity of your data points, or you're not engaging your clients proactively. And ultimately, in that conversation, which is value-based, you start getting the shift of people thinking, ah, there's such amazing about me being data focused. And it's not data just for sake of data. It's data in the context of value and shifting and making the dial. And I think for me, that's a practical way I can try and explain the importance of having a clear data context that you want your data to be measured in context to value that allows the whole organization to just come together and drive it as a collective.
So the real impact shows up when data becomes part of the daily conversation, right? So when teams start to ask better questions, make faster evidence-based decisions, and when the business starts to see measurable improvements in customer outcomes or efficiency.
I think the other element is about democratizing the ability for each business owner to drive that data analyze themselves. So you must enable self-service from a data perspective.
Based in Capitec's journey from a challenger bank to the largest digital bank in South Africa is often held up as a benchmark. So, from your perspective, what were the early or digital di or technology decisions that really shaped that trajectory, particularly in the South African context, with our unique client needs, the infrastructure realities, and regulatory environment?
Yeah, I think label one of the things was just accessibility. The Capitec team thought about making sure we've got distribution that is wide enough to cover the country and even better than our peers. So we obviously today have more than 840 branches. Then accessibility to those branches also was coupled with making sure that the way we deliver our services from a technology point of view, we had a service consultant with terminals, service consultant terminals that were there in front of the clients, sitting side by side, showing the screen to the client. And we designed workflows in our banking system that allowed the clients to simply understand and follow very clearly what the service consultant is doing for every single transaction, whether it's being opened up a bank account or being issued a credit loan. That we designed deliberately to make sure that clients can sit side to side and they can see. So it gives you a sense of trust in that experience. We also over time made sure, and I spoke about it earlier, that our branches open longer than other branches. That meant we have to have more scalability in the back end and make sure our systems are stable and our infrastructure can cater for those volumes. Over time, we understood that self-service is important. So you'll see in our branches, we've got a self-service terminal where we realize a lot of time is being spent in the one-to-one areas with our service consultants by our clients, doing transactions that could be easily done, for example, by the client self-servicing themselves in the self-service terminal. And today, almost 5 to 6 million of those transactions our clients do themselves on our self-service terminal. I think midway through our journey, we launched our app. And I think that digital app, we made sure it was simple and it just was straight to what the needs were that are simplified for the client. And we've kept to that journey. Today, we boast 15 million clients that are using our apps on a regular basis, and they're using that banking app. And we've continuously tried to make sure that services that don't necessarily need to be done in the branch can be serviced on the app. And we continuously make that our objective over time. I think one of the other things that I was excited about is when we ultimately in the branch network realize the importance of authentication for clients to be made simple, because that's one of the things where client, I forgot my ID, or it's difficult for me to we went with a biometric system, and that reduced overheads on the documentation that we had to hold in our branches, but also gave clients an easier way for identification. It was one of the best solutions we brought. But we've continuously over time, from our distribution with our branches to our ATM networks, to our digital app, ultimately to allowing our clients to self-service for complex needs like credit, we've continuously made sure that from a channel point of view, we make it simple for the client to do what they need to do. In the background, we've evolved quite aggressively from just being an on-prem organization. We now run most of our core infrastructure and services in the cloud. We are really a good partner with our AWS counterparts from a cloud point of view, and we're starting to go more and more into domain-driven architecture, where we actually want to make sure that the scalability of our domains is easily managed throughout in a consistent way throughout our channels. So we publish our data and stream our data to our channels across our ecosystem quite simplistically. And now, with obviously having the business bank and the insurance business in our world as well, we make the client the center of everything we do. So we see the client once and we service them across all our businesses in a consistent manner. And that has been some of the key decisions we've made with technology over time that's really led us to the point where we find ourselves now. And I'm excited about a few things that will pivot into the future as well.
From your experience in highly regulated environments, what can policymakers learn from the way businesses balance innovation, risk, and accountability, particularly when it comes to regulating AI?
Okay. What businesses do, as I've highlighted earlier, is focus on the impact. I think one of the things is, what can we shift in on behalf of our clients or on behalf of the country or our citizens when it comes to what regulations bring? I think that should be the first focus for our regulators, and say, how do we then innovate in a way where we can make shifts where we already have regulatory concerns that will drive that impact? So if there's oversight that the regulator would like to have better insights to, I think that's where we want to go and test small use cases, proof of value, using things like AI to support that shift. And over time, from those learnings, start driving policies that we can, broadly distribute around the nation that enable us to learn and grow over time. And I think that's one. Number two, I think it's important for regulators to be open to bringing businesses on board into conversations to test use cases both ways. We must come up with solutions that are incorporating both what the business has learned and what the regulatory environment is trying to achieve. And I think when we start working together in those concepts, in those contexts, we'll probably drive better solutions from a regulatory point of view and policy as well.
Great. When you look back at your early career, which experiences or moments shaped the kind of leader you have become? Was there a moment when your view of leadership fundamentally changed?
I think it has to be in context to the leaders that have come before me, the people that have given me the opportunities in different environments. And I think of moments when early on in my career, I was given the time and day to be mentored and coached by senior executives across the business. Back then, I've always been in financial services, and I've always had the access to individuals who have sat down with me and had conversations that literally were less more about other technology, less more about the specifics of the business, but the why.
Why do we do what we do as a business? Who are we looking to make a difference in? Whose lives are we changing? And I think the one moment has to be the fact that, one of my leaders in the early days just allowed me to travel, just asked me to travel across the world into different countries and get a context and information and understand how the world works and bring that back and build a business case for some of the businesses we had. Giving people exposure to contexts and environments that they don't necessarily traditionally have access to as a leader, I think, is important for your people to learn. And then helping them to hone that into making an impact into their immediate environment really unlocks a lot of potential. So that's probably one. I think the other element would be just the opportunity to drive change that impacts people on a daily basis. I think that was one of the other aspects of my leadership journey that was very empowering. Maybe to simplify that is I've always been given the opportunity to work outside of my current role with small working groups on problem statements that not necessarily are in direct relation to my day-to-day job. And I encourage people that, as leaders, always encourage people to try and find other, vectors of problems that they need to solve that might not directly, relate to what they do on a day-to-day basis, because it expands your context and knowledge and it shifts your thinking in many directions. I think that rounds me up quite well. Yeah, I think those are the two examples, Lebo, that I can maybe share.
And what values have you held on to throughout your career, especially in moments when compromising would have been the easier option?
The one key one is holding to my truth. I think when you are in a position where you're in doubt, the facts that you have on the table will better inform your decision. And sometimes I've been open and honest to say, look, with the facts that I have, this is what I believe that the true direction is, and make sure that my voice is heard. I think it's important that you make that point very clear.
What do you think leaders often underestimate when it comes to developing people?
I think they underestimate the uniqueness of each individual. One of the most important things is to not underestimate the fact that each and every individual you deal with might come with a very unique set of context, background, and perspective. And when you look to develop people, you need to not only apply a standard way of doing things, you need to look for ways and means to unlock the best in the people on specifically based on what they bring. And I think that takes time. That's number one. Number two, just being there to help people navigate some of the areas in their lives that might not necessarily be something that you've experienced before. So having the ability to listen, not to give the answer, but listen to help just the individual get to that answer themselves. I think it's a powerful way of unlocking confidence and making sure the individual can rise to their true potential and sustainably move in a direction that they can self-sustain. I think those are some of the things that leaders underestimate, I think, from a development of people. And then, like I said before, just giving people exposure and time on different problem statements to solve, I think that is a deliberate way of enabling people. People don't necessarily come to a position of being 100% ready for many things unless you actually expose them.
What do you hope your leadership legacy will be?
So, Lebo, I've thought about this question quite a bit, and also in relation to how we opened up the podcast today, my simple view is this. My hope is that anyone who's come in close proximity with Blessing will just say, even if it's by 0.2%, I'm better off for having come into proximity with Blessing, because my interaction with Blessing has made me think differently, or my interaction with Blessing has made me believe in something that maybe will, be better for all of us in future, or just help me to just start moving in a certain direction. So if that is my leadership legacy, I'm very grateful if that I'm able to just achieve that.
Leadership legacy often shows up in the systems organizations inherit, so including your legacy data and platforms that may no longer serve the business. How do you see platform engineering helping organizations modernize those foundations in a way that actually enables teams, number one, rather than creating more complexity?
Yeah. I think when you think about what platform capabilities and engineering can enable, we shift the overheads of complex data and processing into a centralized data ecosystem that can actually start enabling proactive insights. I think about things like enterprise data warehouse. I think about platform engineering, where we build platforms where we can utilize those platforms to enable teams to do software development on a consistent and scalable manner. And in there, you start incorporating AI technologies as well, to start driving a better ways of monitoring, managing, executing in a consistent manner. So that, for me, is the secret to scaling organization. And we need to make sure we've got a focus, execution within what we do that starts with building those scalable platforms as the core of everything that we deliver within the organization. And I think organizations that get it right, if they balance the fact that legacy being built out or legacy being driven out of the organization is not a once-off objective. It's a daily job. You need to constantly ask yourself, what I'm about to deliver, how much of it will drive legacy and slow me down over time versus how much the way I deliver today will scale me and stabilize me. So I think you have to have a healthy balance between building a transformative platform capabilities that scale you, versus just building for the future and trying to take market share with your new products and enhancements.
So building a platform engineering roadmap usually involves many voices, from your product and architecture to DevOps and developers. From your experience, what principles help bring those perspectives together without slowing down execution?
I think, again, agreeing on a policy, a principle that says, what is the key objective of success when it comes to engineering in the organization? How do we measure ourselves as a collective? Whether you're a product team, whether you are a platform team, whether you are a DevOps team. And I think coming up with a concept that is simply agreed by all as the ultimate measure of product engineering discipline in the organization, and all of us having that measure and collectively agreeing that that's the standard for us, that's the gold standard of engineering and platforms, that really helps a lot. And then making sure that each and every party in in that ecosystem has a share of that measure and they drive it. So you'd think about the world architecture framework that AWS speak about. If we all understand that we want our systems to be resilient, that they're available for us to operate with, that we want our deployments to happen on a regular basis, without having to bring down systems when you deploy new enhancements or systems. If you understand that you want your data to be event-driven and available to every channel and streamed at every opportunity, and you give that a measure and you give each and every individual in that ecosystem to say, look, if you are going to be seen as, spearheading the future in terms of what we want to achieve from a platform engineering perspective, that's the true measure. Then individuals will take that measure and we'll go look within the, technology stack all the way from the channels to the backend systems and services. And they will want themselves to work with all the parties, whether it's a platform engineer, whether it's a data engineer, whoever it is, to mature and move their capabilities to a level where the platform has no legacy in it, where it's resilient, where it's available, and ultimately where our data ecosystem as well is at the right levels of quality, the lineage is right. The data architecture meets the standards. And I think we almost need to know that shared objectives that are measured equally in supporting the ecosystems of people that want to work together are the key. So you don't want your people pulling in different directions, and you don't want from the highest level of an organization as well that those objectives are not actually sponsored. So sponsored from the top, the fact that having the best engineering, having the best platforms and having the best data health and integrity and availability is crucial to driving the outcomes, and then give everybody an equal measure in driving that out. And I think that will lift the entire organization, making sure they work collaboratively in that same direction.
What would a high-performing tech and data team look like today?
I think that there's a couple of things for me. One, let me maybe make it three things specifically. One is the a high-performing tech and data team today understands that client outcomes they are trying or they're trying to achieve, right? So that's number one. I think gone are the days where tech and data team sits in the back office in the background and just builds tech for the sake of tech. That's number one. Number two, a high-performing tech and data team today understands how they can scale their business with technology and what architectures need to be deployed in the context of that business and must be accelerated to achieve that. So whether it's your data architecture and how we're going to leverage it with the right platforms that are enterprise ready, that are cloud specific, that drive the right insights and enable the business to do what they do at scale, and they're governed and they're secure, and you know we can trust the data. And then from a technology point of view, platforms that are in place that are modernized, containerized, that are available to scale, and that can be deployed across today what is multi-cloud ecosystem, and they abstract themselves from channels. So technology teams that understand that, and all of this is encapsulated by having a deliberate program within the organization to continuously improve the skills within the organization, and within the organization drive that as an agenda and enable and sponsor people to shift themselves from where they are and understanding what the technology should be in the future. And I think those three elements for me are key in enabling a high performing tech and data organization or tech and data capability in the organization.
All right. So the idea of building these strong teams naturally raises questions about how people learn and grow in this field. And for building careers in data and AI today, how do you think about the balance between formal higher education and more accessible paths like certifications, boot camps, and hands-on learning, considering our context when not everybody has access to formal higher education?
Yeah, I think micro learning and accessible learning is key in this world. And I think what I've learned is that formal education can give you context and give you a perspective and teach you the skills you need to have to be able to learn. But in the ever evolving continuous learning and accelerated learning that we have, micro learning and just in time learning and having a self learning mindset is key in the world we live in from an AI and tech perspective. So certification and working with partners and platform partners to come up with programs like academies that you can, you know, incorporate, sorry, programs that you can incorporate within your organizations is important. So one of the things that is key is one, give your staff access to micro learning and make it your business to invest in that and give them the opportunity to focus on that. Two, reach out to the learning organizations and see if you can develop pipeline learning mechanisms to help your staff internally to go from one area of the business to another should they choose with their learning and a career path that has got micro learning embedded and that enables them to self-serve and get to that point. And then three, I think we must collaborate at an you know at a community and a country level with our you know informal education programs to actually incorporate some of what the learnings are that we can bring into those environments to start reimagining how we teach and how we learn the syllabuses to create more micro learning opportunities for people to actually have a path from learning in the informal way to micro learning all the way to be able to actually access some of the corporate environments we have with being ready to do some technical work at a very early stage in their career.
Before I let you go, Blessing, looking ahead, what excites you most about the future of data, AI, and leadership? And what should we all be paying attention to in the next few years?
I think level one thing, and it's a concept that one whilst I was traveling earlier this year hit me very hard, is the fact that everyone will bring their own agentic AI to work, to home, to their friendship circles. And it means that each and everyone has the opportunity to embrace what the potential upside of AI is for themselves and their organization. And I foresee that in future, we will have much more time as people to focus on the real problem statement that can make a difference if we actually deploy AI in a very meaningful way. And that really excites me, but it comes with its dangers. And we must be aware of the fact that we have to help our people understand where the lines are. You know, how much of your personal information can you share on platforms you don't trust? How much of the agentic AI information that you use must be validated by you secondhand before you actually validate it as your own true voice? And then over time, as we get those capabilities more mature, I see the other side of it where it leads us to a place where people are able to get information quicker, are able to, consume information and process it quicker, and are able to ideate quicker, and we start solving and coming up with solutions that are really meaningful. I think that's the biggest thing that excites me about the potential of AI. But one thing we should not go into the future with is a sense of fear that overcomes our sense of the possibility of making a difference. So we have to push through. We have to drive ourselves to a place where we are actually starting to create the most meaningful solutions with AI. It can be a very good source for good. I'm not undermining the fact that there's a lot of challenges with it accelerating the bad either. So all of the other focus areas for us is making sure that things are safe, right? And a lot of people take advantage of tools like AI as well. So yes, excited with what AI brings. And obviously the foundations must be in place. Your data must be clean. Your lineage must be in place. Your data sources must be verified. You must have governance of those data sources. But once it's there, what AI can bring is absolutely amazing.
Blessing, thank you for giving us a glimpse into the mindset that drives your leadership, and Merry Christmas. Thank you. Thank
Thank you
you.
very much, Deb.
Cheers.
Appreciate it.
Thank you again for joining us. It's been insightful having you on the show. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe, leave a review, or share it with someone who's just as passionate about data as we are. Until next time, keep asking great questions, keep digging into the numbers, and as always, stay curious.